Not too bad. How are you?
I'm doing okay, I guess. We've got some really warm weather today, about 65.
Wow.
Yeah, it's almost like spring, which whenever that happens, I just know we're going to get a big snowstorm in a few days. Whenever that happens in the middle of the winter, anyway.
Yeah. Well,
So,
cold as a witch's elbow right here.
how cold?
Oh, we had minus 37 yesterday.
Oh man. How do you, I just have total respect for you guys up there. I don't know how you do it. That just seems too difficult to me.
It takes a lot of preparation and whatever, but once you're prepared, it's fine, I guess. The nice thing about the cold weather is that it's clear skies, so.
Yeah, you get a real high oxygen content in the air too. One thing I noticed.
Yeah, it's really dense, so you can hear everything really far away.
And also, you can breathe very well.
Depends. Sometimes when you get really, really cold, it kind of freezes in your lungs almost.
Is that right?
Yeah. Feels really fresh and crisp.
Crisp, fresh and crisp while you're freezing your lungs,
Yeah, exactly.
right? Well,
Yeah.
I'm still pounding away on this page 160. I don't know if we have the same. Do we have the same version of the Might of Thoughts? Do you? What's on your page 160? Do you have?
I'd have to go grab my copy. I should go and do that.
Why don't you go ahead and do that?
All right, I'll be right back.
No
Sorry.
problem.
All right, got it. 160, you say.
Yes.
All right. Does it start with the thoughts and are seriously and consciously disposed of, and so on and so forth?
No. See, there's a couple versions of this book. I've noticed this.
Okay.
I must have gotten a later version, maybe slightly.
Yeah.
It starts out and says only, well, this is like the second line.
Okay.
It says only a conscious or unconscious purposefulness is able to bring one's thoughts to fruition.
Right.
And I don't even know if you can find that in yours or not.
I wouldn't start looking. The whole show.
Okay.
But that is a good line.
It is a very good line, and I've been trying to break it down. First of all, and this is kind of external research I've done, not really Billy's stuff per se, which I wish he would write on the conscious and unconscious mind. He may have a whole book dedicated to this that hasn't been translated yet. I really don't know. Do you know?
Oh, most likely, of course. That
Yeah,
seems to be the main crux of the whole matter, so I would certainly imagine that they would go into that in
did
some.
he, when you were out there, did he ever talk to you about this at all, the conscious or unconscious mind?
Not directly. And I can't think of anything per se. I don't know. No, not exactly. I mean, we haven't talked too much in depth about these topics yet, so. But I talk about it, about different things more like with the other core group members because, they're out doing stuff with us and all that sort of thing. So when I'm
How
going
many
there.
times have you been out to Switzerland?
I think 5 times now.
And you go every year, right?
Yeah, now I do. Yeah.
And when do you plan to go again, or do you know yet?
Sometime this year. I'm not sure yet exactly. So when it warms up.
Do you go in the summer?
Yeah, usually. Yeah. So
Wow,
it's
that's
nice to be
cool.
able to put your tent up, So
Is that what you do? You stay outside?
yeah, it's great. I love it. Beautiful birds and stuff singing in the morning, and it's just a gorgeous place. So
So you stay right on the property there with your tent?
yeah, I might as well. I mean, some people would rather stay in a hotel or whatever, and most people do actually,
You
but
spend more money that way, right?
yeah, with a tent, it's really much cheaper. So.
And do you go alone?
Usually I just go alone, yeah. I think a few people are wanting to come with me this time, though, and meet me there this year, so I'm not sure exactly how that'll work out, but
And
whatever.
you never really know if you're going to see him or not, right?
No, I mean, he's just you know, that's where he lives, and he's busy doing, you know, they're all busy doing their stuff there, so you never know who you're going to see, and every time I go there, I meet new people, so it's always a good experience.
Is that right? Is that right?
Yeah.
Do you meet, like, core group members?
Of course, yeah. They're all, you know, helping with this and that, and we're all working together and stuff, so it's enjoyable.
And so. Is it like a 12-hour flight out there?
No, not from here anyway. We have direct flights from where I am, which is really nice because so many Germans like to come here. So it's actually direct to Frankfurt. So, and then I can just hop over into Switzerland, which is pretty close by. So,
well, that's cool.
Yeah, it's really nice.
That's very cool. Yeah. And I'll have to, we could have even done this time. There's so much topic. There's so much material associated to this. I even started looking at the German a little bit, and hopefully I'll remember to come back to doing that next time I do the show, because this, for some reason, was a good line for, I can look right at the German and see which is the corresponding English word. It's real easy. Like, and I'm going to pronounce this horribly, bewusst.
Bewusst, yeah.
Yeah, that's conscious. And unbewusst is unconscious.
Okay.
And purposefulness is Zielstrebigkeit or something along those lines.
Okay.
But there's a great URL called dick.cc, and if you type in the German word, it will pronounce it for you and as well as give you a definition.
Right.
So.
Yeah, I've used that before. I used to have an app on my iPod or whatever. And then they changed it, and then I just couldn't keep track anymore of what was being changed on it, so I stopped using it. But I try it on the website, and it works great, so yeah, for sure.
Okay, let me dive into this. Only a conscious or unconscious purposefulness is able to bring one's thoughts to fruition. Now, that's a hard sentence. So what I did was shorten it just a little bit, and if you think of it as purposefulness is able to bring one's thoughts to fruition. That's a little simpler. So now I'm starting to understand that if we have a purpose, we can bring our thoughts into reality. Now, the beginning of that sentence is only, which is a really important word, only conscious or unconscious purposefulness is able to bring one's thoughts to fruition. So here's where we're starting to get really deeply profound, because the unconsciousness can have a purposefulness, which I find that amazing and a little shocking and bizarre, and I'd like for you to comment on that.
That is something I've had to explore, really? Certainly. And when you showed me that, I thought, yep, that's exactly right, because for me, it always comes down to, you know, the things that I've done. And, you know, for me, when I'm working on a project or coming up with a new project or something, and over time, if there really is a good purpose behind it, it seems to work out better, seems to work out more logically. And I have to be logical about things. I can't just, you know, be a Pollyanna about everything. And when you put the conscious and unconscious together, that's when you have power. It's huge. It's really huge.
Absolutely. I'm going to ask a hard question now. Have you figured out how to do that? And could you break that down?
Well, I've dabbled, you know, and I mean, I wouldn't consider myself, you know, an expert in this, but I've certainly, like, for example, let me see if I can think of something. Like, when I'm, for example, learning something, a new kind of music per se or something, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. For me, you know, I always wanted to be into the music because I wanted to bring harmony into the world, because there's so much disharmonious music in the world that is counter to harmony and so on, and I figured that's something that really helps with the conscious mind. And throughout my years growing up as a kid, I had to follow in certain ways of doing things, and you know, the best way to make things line up in your life to really get to the next level or, you know, that sort of thing in something that is useful in this regard. And same thing happened with my calculations, is to bring the conscious and the unconscious together. And it's difficult to describe. I mean, like, when I thought about certain musicians that I'd like to emulate or something like that growing up, you know, I really had to delve into it subconsciously. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for example, for me, personally, I really, 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 really love, Stan Getz. He's a saxophone player.
Sure.
He did some really nice bossa nova stuff in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And the Girl from Ipanema and all that stuff, of course.
I like bossa nova.
Oh, it's wonderful. Yeah. And just his taste and his flavor is just so beyond anything I've found anywhere else in terms of just how awesome it is. And I still have the same feeling. And I really had to see it in a subconscious way, in a way that, you know, I had to kind of try and engulf the personality behind the music, in a sense, not to emulate it, but to see what it is, to feel what is this person thinking, what's going through his mind when he makes this music and all this kind of thing. And then to bring that into the conscious realm so that you become conscious of it, mm-hmm. and be able to apply it and do it and you know, doing certain exercises and things that you can do it's really difficult to describe. I mean, it's something that you have to really experience for yourself in a way. But the calculations worked out in the same way, because it was very much an unconscious thing when I would think of something new, because I would have to, I was, you know, every time I would think of something new, I was hitting rock bottom, first of all. And so I had nowhere else to go. You know, it was sort of it was just rock bottom, you know, that rock bottom is rock bottom. So, and then you bounce back up from the bottom, right?
Well, but that's interesting that you say that, because I want to get into that a little bit as we go on. Because Billy talks about unconscious zeal, unconscious striving, and if we allow our thoughts to drift, that the unconscious can take over, and that usually leads to all sorts of unpleasant experiences. But go ahead, continue.
This is exactly true. you know, it's sort of, for me personally, it was an amalgamation of many different angles and experiences. And it wasn't just music. It wasn't just, you know, this or that, you know, it was many different things as I was exploring, you know, while I was growing up and things too, and figuring things out and trying to figure out which direction I want to go and all this sort of thing. And so, you know, one thing that does pop into my mind is Robin Williams.
Oh,
because some of his movies were kind of dark, you know, and I always kind of thought about that, because Robin Williams, I mean, obviously had his problems, his psychological problems and whatever. Now, and
did he not die recently?
Yeah, he did commit suicide. Yeah,
he killed himself.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
And, so he probably was being influenced by his unconscious.
I guess my interpretation of it when I was growing up was that he had very much difficulty kind of piecing it together. He was exploring, you know, different things, and he was breaking new ground for himself. And I think he must have had difficulty trying to piece it together in a coherent way. And that's what I thought when I was growing up, when I was watching his movies. And even when I was younger, like, you know, in my teens, I figured by watching these movies that it's possible he might one day commit suicide.
No kidding.
It was just something that kind of came through into my subconscious mind. And yeah. And you can kind of see, like, well, I could kind of see that these patterns were going on, and like he was exploring like places. I don't know if you've ever had this feeling where you're sort of avoiding where everyone's going, you know, you're kind of ending up, you want to be in a place where there isn't anyone there. You're not not in a try and find peace manner, but in an exploratory manner. And you're trying to discover something that may not have been discovered yet. And that is a difficult place to be in. And some of his darker movies were basically that's what they were. And so they were sort of exploring something that was, it's very hard to put into words. It's exploring a place that is desolate, you know?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
And that I think is probably the main word I could use. And desolate and just completely unexplored, not grasped at all. And it can be very difficult. And so when you're kind of in those areas, you know, you're like standing in the middle of the wilderness, basically. That's kind of how it feels. And, you know, you can shout out to the world and no one will hear you. And, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. And that's kind of how that some of his movies kind of made me feel too. And because you could see in his comedy, he was overreaching himself. Like he was always giving more of himself, you know, than would be humanly possible for most people to do. And he was diving into people's lives, into people's personalities to get them to respond and to wake up and, you know, that sort of thing. And not to be too, like he was breaking out of his shell constantly and all that sort of thing and getting other people to break out of their shells maybe too or whatever, you know. And that was really, really the crux of his genius. And he would really dive into people and their personalities. And when he made the movie Patch Adams, you could really see even Patch Adams, the real person, Patch Adams in real life, didn't really like that movie because he basically thought, well, it's a movie about Robin Williams. And it pretty much is, you know, because the whole point of that movie is to break the barriers, I guess, between people and to connect with people. And it's not an easy thing to do, especially in our world, you know, where people are so afraid and so, you know, afraid to express themselves, afraid to express their ideas maybe, or maybe they have some anger issues or whatever it might be based on, you know, certain contradictions that they're trying to work out in their minds or whatever it might be. And anyways, and so when I think about the unconscious and subconscious, I there's all these different stories that I've kind of worked through in my own life, you know, and that's the way I can try to describe it, but it's not easy.
The let me read again from Might of Thoughts, page 160. Only a conscious or unconscious purposefulness is able to bring one's thoughts to fruition. Therefore, the might of the thoughts is only effective when there is a definite intention, indeed, a setting of the zeal connected with the thoughts. Mm-hmm. Well, what we've been talking about is the conscious and the unconscious mind. Let me read a little bit of information here. I've been doing a little research on this. This is not the Meyer material, but I think it helps fill in some of the dots. Like I said, if Billy's written, I wouldn't doubt if Billy's written whole books on this, but the conscious mind is your awareness at the present moment. Sometimes we are said to have three minds, the conscious, the subconscious, the unconscious. The conscious mind is your objective thinking mind. Here's something I didn't know. It has no memory. I'd like to validate that. And it can only hold one thought at a time.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that.
Yeah.
The conscious mind identifies things, it compares information, it does analysis, and it makes a decision. Now, the subconscious mind is also called the preconscious mind, and it consists of accessible information. So you can become aware of information once you direct your attention to it, and it's possible that some of what is perceived to be unconscious becomes subconscious and then conscious. An example of that would be a long forgotten childhood memory suddenly emerges after decades.
Mm-hmm.
The unconscious mind, and this is where we're getting into what you're talking about, the unconscious mind consists of primitive instinctual wishes as well as information that we cannot even access. And the unconscious is the part of the mind, again, that is supposed to be inaccessible to our conscious mind, but yet it's affecting our behavior. It's affecting our emotions. And Freud has done some psychoanalytic theory on this, and he says the unconscious mind is a reservoir of feelings, thoughts, urges, and memories that are outside of our conscious awareness. Now, so I guess, and we'll get to this a little bit later, but what Billy is saying is don't let your unconscious mind drive the motorcycle. Because it's going to go somewhere dark. So yeah, maybe we can use the both together, but the conscious mind should be steering. Right. So can you comment on any of that?
Well, it's interesting when you mentioned how the conscious mind has no memories and you can only focus on one thing at a time. When I completed my calculations, more or less, I was just beginning my 12th grade of high school.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I made a conscious choice in August of that year to stop, at the end of August of that year, to stop trying to organize all this stuff in my mind, because I was trying to become conscious of too many things at once, and you're right, you can't really be conscious of more than one or two, three things maybe at a time,
mm-hmm.
Consciously speaking, and I was making myself crazy. So the calculations were basically finished enough that I could, you know, use them in my later life and until I found the Meyer case and test it out. And so then, but when I was making those calculations, it was a subconscious effort. So I would be at rock bottom and I would just let the thoughts come through.
Mm.
And sometimes I would use dreams. That was more effective in my music life, but at that time. But I mean, the subconscious, or I'm not sure if the unconscious or subconscious, I'm not sure in Billy's definitions if they're the same or not, but but there is an enormous power in that. And when you learn to try to tap into that, you have to step away. You have to basically... Like, when I was at rock bottom, I was at the giving up stage, you know? Like, I had to give up what I thought, what I knew, what I believed, or whatever. And I was in that place of exploration. I was in the middle of that wilderness, and you just have to stop, wait, listen, and see what comes up. And that is huge power in that. And I can tell you, every single one of my calculations came out from that. That was exactly where every one of those point by point came from. It was from listening. It was from observing. And there's one thing I just want to get into before we move on, is when I'm where I grew up, even now, out in nature, one really interesting thing that I observe, very interesting thing, is because it's all natural. There's no houses anywhere. You don't see any street lights. You know, there's no power lines or towers in the mountains or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're in that, even for a few hours, what you begin to notice is that your thoughts are really just observations. You're observing nature.
Uh-huh.
So you're not forcing yourself to think of something, whatever, blah, blah, blah. No, it's an observation. You're observing what's going on around you.
Hmm.
And that's something I think that would be maybe a useful little piece of information, because I wasn't consciously aware of that when I was growing up. And here I was in, you know, high school, you know, elementary school, whatever, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I was being forced all this stuff, this information, and you know, I could make sense of some of it and use some of it, like especially from elementary school. You know, I learned to read and write. I learned, you know, basic math and stuff like that and so on. But I could apply that then to my observing, and my scope of awareness really grew from that. But just being in nature really made me realize that I wasn't thinking of these calculations in the same sense that, you know, people might consider the word thinking. I was observing, and I just pulled myself out of the picture, got rid of my beliefs. I didn't let my, you know, whatever thoughts try to influence anything. That's why I used probability as much as I can. And it was a subconscious way of doing it, but it was still, you know, it was very effective. And it's observing. That's what thinking is. It's observing.
Yeah, that's a whole topic into itself to try to get a handle on that.
Mm-hmm.
I understand. I have a sense of what you're saying there. To break that down and to really analyze it would probably be a big deal, I would imagine. I don't think we could do that just by chance. Like, we'd have to like really put some intention together to
try. You know, like Billy says, you know, when people ask him, how do you prove the spirit exists? You know, well, it's a proof into itself. Mm. And I can attest to that, you know, just from doing this kind of, you know, observing. And this discovering these sort of things is just something you have to do. And
I wonder, you know, like a lot of times when I'm reading some of Billy's material and it's really super profound, and I feel like I've just understood something so massive, I must be understanding it more at an unconscious and subconscious level, because it sometimes can take years to be able to get it to bubble to the surface and then get it where I can explain it. You know what I mean?
Right.
That someone else might have ability to understand what I'm saying.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's, you know, that's the stages of learning, right? You read it once and then you kind of forget it, and then read it twice and maybe you start to remember it, and then you start to eventually learn to hopefully apply it or understand it. And then once you can learn to apply it, then you have, hopefully that's what you would consider the knowledge of it.
So the contents of the unconscious sometimes can be unacceptable, unpleasant. We can have feelings of pain, anxiety, or conflict in there.
And it is conflict that you're trying to sort out, though.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
That's the whole point. That's the whole point. You want to look into the subconscious because it's telling you what you understand. So if there's something really unpleasant in there, examine it, because it's there to tell you something really useful if you can.
Well, the difficulty is, though, is in analyzing it. Like, sometimes something will make you really angry, and you're trying to figure out, well, why in the heck is that making me angry? And then usually you can come up with a few things, but it's just the surface of, you know, what it really is. So deep in your subconscious and your unconscious, wherever that dark place is that understands things at a clearer level, it has information that you don't have in the conscious. So yeah, that's a good question. Do we dive into that dark, scary area?
Absolutely. And do it in a way that you don't, you have to remove yourself from.
How can you do that, though, without letting your thoughts run out of control?
Well, that's the thing. You have to, that's like when I was, you know, doing my calculations and stuff, I was deeply depressed and so on and so forth. Like every time, like I say, I hit rock bottom, and that's kind of how that worked. And it would force me to really and truly examine the contradictions that I was living by, because the contradictions are the things that made me unhappy. You know, the universe is operating very efficiently, and, you know, for us to come here and, you know, we have our silly ideas about things. Well, you know, most of those silly ideas are based on assumptions, and they have nothing to do with true observation of the way nature works. And so we're building an entire society around these really old, you know, Bronze Age ideas or whatever it might be, you know, and so on and so forth, that are very contradictory in themselves. And so there's an enormous amount of unhappiness for that reason, I think. And, you know, some people might not agree or whatever, but, you know, the more I've looked at it, the more I see that being the case. And, you know, when you have to examine the contradictions.
Well,
that's how you learn.
One of the huge contradictions that I saw this week, I had a guest on. His name is Frosty Wooldridge, and he's a big population studier. He taught his population immigration. Used to be a math teacher in high school and that sort of thing. And he's written books now on overpopulation. And he showed me, he said something in passing, and I didn't believe him. And I think I told you about this. In China, he was talking about this gigantic traffic jam that was 200 miles long, and there were 50 lanes involved in the traffic jam. And I couldn't believe him. I said, not 50 lanes. That's just not even possible. That's just too much. Well, he sent me the YouTube videos, and I saw 50 lanes of traffic. And you talk about contradictions. My God, can you imagine the insanity of creating 50 lanes of traffic? That's total insanity.
Yeah, and those traffic jams can last months. They have people they hire to keep driving their car during the day while they go to work. I mean, how insane is that?
No. You're lying.
Yeah, you have people delivering them pizzas and everything. It's ridiculous. It's insane. Yeah. No, it's. I think that was a world record breaker at that. It lasted like six or I don't know how many months.
It didn't last months. Come on, it had to last. I can see weeks. It didn't last months. You got to be kidding me.
It's amazing. Yeah. No, it was clear mind.
You send me the link. I got to see this. I can't believe it lasted months.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God.
It's ridiculous.
It's so absurd. So, and before I came across the Meyer material, I didn't even realize population was a problem. And Billy kept saying, "Oh, population is a problem." He keeps writing all the stuff. I'm like, really? Is it a problem? And then I started doing a little research, and it's just so over the top a problem. But we're kind of isolated from it a little.
Kind of. I mean,
I see it here when I drive into Columbus. I see the traffic jams. It's every morning there's a traffic jam. But it's only like six lanes, which is pretty bad, I think.
Yeah.
But 50 is just 50 going one way, too.
Well, that's, you know, how many parts of the country are like that. I mean, you see your little town where you are, you know, and that's it. But, you know, the whole world is running like that, and some places way worse.
I know. So, it's just beyond my imagination. So,
because I grew up in a place that's, you know, twice the size of the UK, and it's got 35,000 people in it. You know, that's when you grow up in an environment like that, you realize how much freedom you have compared to some city kid in Vancouver. Some city kid in Vancouver comes here and they're blown away.
Yeah.
Completely blown away. They have never, ever, ever even fathomed that freedom could exist.
Indeed.
So people that say we don't have an overpopulation issue, it's because they have no clue what it's like to live in a place like that. They have no clue. They have never done it. They've never even imagined it.
See, and you talk about depression and anxiety. Living in a place like that causes, you know, depression and anxiety when you're in an overcrowded environment. I grew up in Cincinnati, which, you know, is nothing like Beijing, which we were talking about, or it's nothing like Bangladesh, but it's fairly crowded. and it was depressing to me, and I could feel it being depressing. And I always thought all the cars and the concrete and all that is very depressing. And I wanted to get out of it, but I just, you know, I didn't know how or what to do. But I think my unconscious mind eventually figured something out. Yeah. And I got a job offer out of it. So anyway, this unconscious mind is often, it's represented as an iceberg, where everything above the water represents our conscious awareness, while everything below the water represents the unconscious. And the rest of the information that's outside of our conscious awareness is below the surface. And Freud said that many of our feelings, our desires, our emotions are repressed. Don't you agree? And held out of sight of our awareness.
I just lost you for a second there. Sorry. I just kind of cut out.
Many of our desires, thoughts, feelings, and emotions are outside of our awareness.
Yes.
In the unconscious.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. When you look at, you know, when I'm in a city, for example, and, you know, it's just a concrete jungle, basically, and there's a few trees here and there, whoop-de-doo, like, yeah, you know, that's not nature, I'm sorry. how much green space you think you have, I mean, when you really see the way nature flows, like, you look at a mountain range that hasn't been disturbed, or you look at a forest that hasn't been disturbed, or a river that hasn't been disturbed, there's enormous intelligence, and not intelligence, but just enormous...
I think intelligence.
Efficiency.
Yeah, intelligence is a good word.
It could be. It's just an efficiency, though, that is there about every single rock in that mountain, the way it's placed, and so on and so forth, and every single, you know, way the water falls and brings, you know, certain silt down or whatever it might be, or, you know, so on and so forth. All the chemical reactions and the things in the rocks and in the minerals and the, you know, all that stuff, and you see where, you know, all the glaciers have come through at one point and so on. And you can, when you look at that natural development, there is an efficiency that you notice that isn't there in the cities. The cities are just basically a blockage of energy. I mean, there's, you know, in terms of the natural world, and that's why, of course, you know, our cities are so, you know, polluting and destructive, and especially now with, you know, pretty much 9 billion people now that we have on the planet. I mean, that's an insane number. And that's doubled in my lifetime.
Yeah, I know. That's astonishing.
Yeah, and people, you know, still don't want to acknowledge that, you know, that, you know, technology isn't going to solve it because...
Right.
You know, yeah, I mean, you have... You know, 100 million people without power in a certain country, maybe India or something, or even 20 million people without power, without sewage treatment, without water, clean water, you know, and so on and so forth. And, you know, the time it takes to build the necessary plants to serve those 20 million people, well, 10 years down the road, we're going to have another 1 billion people, not even 10 years now. I think it's even, like, less than that now, at the rate we're going. It's 1 billion people now, additionally, that we're going to have to feed and, you know, clothe and educate and treat sewage and all this stuff. And we already don't have any room for it the way we are now. Like, we're running out of places to put our nuclear waste. We're running out of places, you know, on and on. I mean, it just costs more and more to build things. Materials cost more and more. You know, we're seeing huge inflation because, yeah, well, more and more people are sharing less and less stuff. I mean, it's not rocket science. You know, you can mine it all out of the ground, and then you're left with, you know, just bricks of nothing. And, you know, the whole world is, you know, destroyed. The oceans are getting destroyed. The climate change is, you know, destroying. It's the rate that, you know, we can find new technologies to feed people. I think climate change is going to wipe that out. All those efforts out way faster than any new technologies are going to be able to solve that. So,
and from my research, and it's really interesting because if you study the Meyer material, sometimes he doesn't spell everything out for you. Mm-hmm. And one thing he didn't spell out, and I think the Pleiarian, I heard someone else say this once, James, I think it was James Moore, the guy that runs the Future of Mankind wiki. He said that sometimes the Pleiarian will not tell us certain things, but they'll give us information so that we can do the research on our own, and then we really learn it. Well, I was real frustrated because I wanted Billy to spell out, you know, what was overpopulation doing to the planet in more detail. And he does to a degree say it, but what I found is that the forests moderate the weather. And what they do is they, in the winter time, they store heat. They don't reflect as much light back. in the summer, they create shade, so it keeps the ground and the air cooler. They also produce a turbulence, so when wind blows over the top of the forest, it causes the turbulence, and the turbulence makes air go vertically instead of just horizontally, breaks up the strong winds, and it also leads to more rain. So there's all these things that the forest is doing. It's stopping erosion. It's basically keeping us alive. So what we do is we go in with bulldozers and we knock down the forest, which kills, you know, all the plants and causes the death of how many animals eventually. And not only that, it causes the weather to turn more and more extreme. So with, you know, in our lifetime, and you could probably agree with me, we've gone from, what, 4 billion to about 9 billion or whatever it is, 3 billion, 8 billion. I don't know what the exact number is, but it's basically doubled. And what we have now is extreme weather. Like right now in January in Ohio, it's 65 degrees. I never, ever, ever experienced that as a kid. It would always be cold in January, always.
Right.
So,
I mean, we're having a warm year, just so you know, like minus 37 Celsius. I mean, that's actually pretty warm for this time of year.
What is that in Fahrenheit? Same thing?
I guess it comes together at 40. That's one thing I got wrong in the first interview. Is it comes together at 40 degrees. So minus 40 is Celsius is minus 40 Fahrenheit.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So it's even colder usually there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, usually it's minus 45. You know, my record growing up was minus 58 Celsius. We have, you know, people that have lived here for, you know, 60, 70 years, whatever. And when they were growing up, you know, that's minus 50, minus 60 was, you know, normal for months. So whenever somebody tells me that climate change isn't happening, you know, well, fine, I'm not going to argue with you because obviously you're not observing reality. You're just observing what the media is telling you, and that's not really reality. So anyone who's supporting the oil companies, yeah, whatever, not really worth paying attention to. So yeah, I can certainly attest to the fact that it's changing here too.
To get back to this whole unconscious, subconscious thing, Freud believed that we have these hidden desires which sometimes will make themselves known when we have these slips of the tongue, the Freudian slips, so to speak. That's another thing of the unconscious and the subconscious. Now, getting back to climate change and overpopulation, see, this is really interesting, and this is one of the things I've been learning from the Meyer material, is that the whole human population is a we form, which means we're all connected. We just don't understand how all that works yet. If I could get wax a little poetic, I would say flocks of birds are we form. They move together instantly, change direction. They're all connected. And it talks about the psychic swinging waves in the Meyer material, and schools of fish are the same way. You can sometimes see deer behaving this way. But even our conversation in this limited way, and eventually it'll be put up on the web, going out to a wider audience, will have impact on the we form through the conscious mind. You and I are now connected consciously. We'll have this discussion. A certain number of people will listen to it consciously, but we're all in this connection unconsciously. So what'll happen, I think, over time is people will become aware of their unconscious angst, you know, and they'll go try to figure out, well, why am I feeling this? And then some of it will become aware of them as overpopulation and climate change resulting from that and So anyway, that's how I think it's going to all happen and unfold.
For sure, it has to. And I always thought about that, you know, in terms of people taking drugs to sort of calm themselves down in that sense. It doesn't help anything because you're still not getting to the base of what those thoughts really are. You're not getting into the crux of what is actually going on in your mind. It's just covering it up with, you know, a nice, it's like icing a mud pie.
So what they're doing is they're avoiding their unconscious angst.
Yeah, exactly. They're not confronting what is actually being processed in their mind and why that anxiety is coming out. And so they're pushing it down the road, pushing it down the road, and of course their mind, you know, gets screwed up with drugs too, and certainly that doesn't help if your mind is physically destroyed to try and figure out what the problem is. So it just gets worse and worse and worse. So I never thought I would want to do that, so that's why I've avoided drugs my entire life. So
that's some profound wisdom there. I'm glad you shared that.
Yeah.
You know, have you ever heard of a guy named Carl Graff? Did we?
No.
Okay, I thought maybe it was us, me and you were talking about.
It's but possible.
It was one of Billy's teachers.
Okay.
He had a, and Carl Graff knew Pastor Rudolf Zimmerman, right?
Right.
You've heard of him.
Yeah.
Well, Carl Graff also knew Professor Gustav Jung.
Mm.
Yeah, he was a well-known psychologist and psychiatrist.
Right.
And Billy told Carl Graff, his teacher, about his contacts with Svoth. And in fact, Carl Graff even got to see Svoth's ship once.
Yeah. Wow.
So anyway, Billy would ask these profound questions, you know, like we're having this profound discussion right now. And Billy would ask, I guess he was probably 5 or 6 years old, and he would ask Carl Graff these very profound questions, which Carl could not answer.
Mm.
And he would go to this psychologist, Gustav Jung, Professor Carl Gustav Jung, and ask him. And this professor became very interested. He's like, who is this young boy that's asking you these questions? And this professor said, could I see a photograph of him? And so Carl produced a photograph. And so Professor Jung eventually got to meet Billy at one time.
Wow.
And for like 45 minutes they talked or something like that. And that was just something that I had stumbled across today in Contact Report 200 because I was searching around to see if Billy had said anything about Freud. Because I don't know how much of Freud's actual ideas are correct, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think there was some mention of it somewhere, and I guess he wasn't particularly impressed with everything about him, but I do remember hearing about the connection with Carl Jung, and I never got to find that contact report, so thanks for bringing that up. I'm going to look into that later.
You know, I hate reading. Reading them online is really unhealthy to do that. You probably know that, right?
Yes, I do.
and thanks for sharing with me some of the dangers of the humidifiers. I went and cleaned all my humidifiers after our discussion.
Well, right on.
I probably shouldn't even be using them, but I think that not using them at this point is probably worse. I don't know. So I'd hate to say that because there's, you know, here's the thing again. Billy doesn't always tell you everything. You have to go out and figure some stuff out on your own. So that's one.
You just boil a pot of water on the stove and it's fine. It certainly humidifies the place.
That's another way to do it. That might even be maybe better.
It's a natural way to create steam. So it's not a cold mist, you know, version that they talk about being not so healthy.
And I think you're right. The cold mist versions aren't as healthy.
Right. And they were talking about that on the Canadian health website. That's the link I sent you after the Canadian health something or other website, government website. And they were talking about different kinds of humidifiers, some of them being more healthy than others, too. So that's interesting.
That's very interesting. Now, do you have much connection with Canadian FIGU people?
A little bit. Not as much as I'd like because I'm so far away from them. It's easier for me to get to Switzerland. A friend of mine just came over from Quebec, and it was like 7 hours by plane, and it's like 9 hours for me to get to Frankfurt. So, I mean, what am I going to do, right?
That's
go to the Alps or go to, you know, some flat, overpopulated place in Toronto. I mean, and it costs way more, by the way, to get across Canada than it does for me to get to Frankfurt. So.
That's interesting.
Yeah, makes sense of that. Why don't you? Yeah,
that's so bizarre. It's so interesting.
Yeah. And there's no, you know, connections for me to get to Frankfurt. It's just one flight where it's like two or three flights to get to like Montreal or something. So yeah, it's ridiculous. I don't know.
so the principle here that we're trying to discuss, and we've got really very interesting discussion into the conscious and unconscious mind. But the point here is that purposefulness is able to bring your thoughts to fruition. Mm. And the might of thoughts is only effective when there is a definite intention, a definite setting of a zeal. Mm-hmm. And the zeal, the word zeal, do you remember that word at all?
Yeah, it comes up quite often, I guess, eh?
It does. And he doesn't like to call it a goal.
Right.
He likes to call it an ultimate destination or an endpoint.
That's interesting.
I haven't quite grasped the difference that he's trying to convey there yet.
Okay. Yeah, I guess goal can be kind of
smaller or vague, or
it can sometimes pigeonhole you too much into one little thing, you know. Whereas when you're setting sort of a destination, you can have, you know, more options with regards to your journey, I guess. And then you, like, for example, when you're talking about the phrase you just mentioned, setting a zeal and setting, I don't know exactly the wording that you used again, but, you know, when I first started doing these calculations, for example, when I was 7 years old, I knew that this contact case existed, and I knew that there was some group that was trying to disseminate this information. Mm-hmm. Nobody ever told me about it, and it was a totally subconscious thing.
Hmm.
And I knew that I was a part of this, and I even came up with the word codex, you know, and that I was part of this codex. And I guess it stopped in 1995. That was kind of the story with that. And this must have been in 1992 that I came up with this. And that sort of started my journey on this direction of sort of breaking up the monopolies of the religious thinking and all this kind of stuff and all the, you know, government controls that are kind of holding us back and all these really destructive ideas. And I needed to find this group. I needed to find this information, sort of get going on that path. And so that's why I did the calculations. And, you know, 10 years after I finished the calculations, I found FIGU, and there, you know, all the information is there exactly the way I figured it would be. So,
did you get confirmation from FIGU that you were part of the codex?
I just kind of take it for myself because I, mm-hmm. I haven't asked anybody, but it's highly likely in this case because the way that I sort of grew up and when I was young, just kind of came up with that word. I knew that I was part of this mission and all this stuff, and I felt like I had no choice about it in that respect. And that's when I was 9 years old, I felt like, you know, like I wanted to end my life because I didn't really want to go down that path. I didn't want to explore all this dark stuff and everything, but I figured I had to, and that would really improve my understanding. And once I get through all that, then I'd feel a lot better about life. And sure enough, that's kind of what happened. So,
So here's the question then. If Billy is telling us, now this next line is really interesting, that the intention or setting of the zeal can thereby be created consciously or also unconsciously, which is just stunning to me. How is my unconscious mind setting goals? Slightly scary. We should be consciously steering our thoughts. But what you're saying is sometimes examining the unconscious is a good idea if you don't go too far, right?
Well, you're using your conscious mind to examine the unconscious. I mean, that's, you know, I'm becoming conscious of what's unconscious. So when I'm looking at these thoughts and these things, they are conscious when I'm thinking about them. And coming up with these observations and things when I'm observing, that's a conscious effort. So it's not it's not a huge effort. It's sort of like maybe the word powerlessness or powerless powerfulness, or I'm not sure exactly what the word that they use, but it does sort of fit that sort of description, because it's kind of an intention, but it's not a goal, you know, and that's
now we're getting
it's
real...
an intent to increase my understanding.
That is huge. You've made a distinction between an intention and a goal. And this is where I have to pull out my dictionary. So an intention is, well, I've heard it defined this way, is an aim or a plan. So it's a little more open-ended than a goal, right?
For sure. Yeah. Because, you know, my intentions were manifold. It wasn't just one goal. It wasn't just to find the people. It was manifold. It was to break away from old ideas. It was to improve or get rid of some of the contradictions in my ideas, and, you know, on and on and on. There was many, many, many things there. So I wouldn't call that a goal. I would call it, you know, an intent to increase my understanding. That's pretty much all it was. So that's why I wanted to use probability in that sense. And very, very easy probability that I don't have to really do maths for, because I'm not a mathematician. So this is stuff that anybody and their grandma's cat can figure out for themselves. It's not for anybody, you know.
Your grandma's cat. My goodness. Do you guys have cats up there freezing in that 30 below weather?
Oh, yeah. When I was growing up, we had one cat that froze up outside, unfortunately.
Oh, that's terrible.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, it's not really a place designed for cats anyway, and it's not really healthy to have them indoors, so we have lynx and stuff that stay outside, and they're doing fine, so.
Okay. My cats live in the garage, but sometimes they'll sneak in the doggy door a little bit to visit us, and then run back out when the dog comes around.
Right.
So we haven't quite, we still have dogs inside, well, one dog, and we lost the other, but that's a harsh environment up there, but very beautiful at the same time, right?
Oh, it's great, because it teaches you, you know, the universe is here to be learned about, and if you ignore it, you know, the big red button, sort of through cause and effect, you know, will tell you, hey, you know, you better learn something here or you're going to die. So that's kind of...
No kidding.
When you're at the edge of it, you're not stuck in a city, you know, comforted by all your, you know, manufactured crap that, you know, wasn't put there really by nature in that sense. Like, when you're at the edge of it, you can kind of look back at the world from the point of view of what you have from a very, you know, crude, if you will. I'm not sure if crude is the right answer, but crass, you know, nature isn't there just to play games with us. It's you know, it's there to teach us, and if we don't respect it, you die. People die.
Profoundly crude the way you put that. I like your upfrontness. That's really...
Nature is up front, you know, like I'm just the messenger here.
You know, and it's interesting that I think the dark forces, let's call them the global dark forces, are trying to pull us into this political correctness, which is the antithesis of being truthful in a way.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is. You know, I mean, what's politically correct today is totally different tomorrow. So how can that be a judgment of truth? It can't be. It can't be. You know, 2 + 2 = 4, and that was true for my grandparents and their grandparents and on and on. So it was probably true for the caveman, and, you know, it'll always be true. So, I mean, that's the difference. So...
Well, we're out of our hour. It's been very pleasurable as always. I thank you for your time, Daniel.
Time flies, doesn't it?
It does. And if you have any more profound insights here in the last minute, please throw it on us.
Well, they just come out when they need to. That's
okay.
Yeah.
You can't force them. Well, no. Thank you. And we'll continue our discussion of Maya thoughts some future day. Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye.